Hello, I'm Guy Foster, and in this week's podcast, I'm speaking to Nigel Inkster. Nigel is a former member of the intelligence community who's now the author of a new book exploring the relationship between China and the US. He's also working for Enodo Economics, who provide incredible thought-provoking matters related to China, and that's how we know him best. But bear in mind, we can't guarantee sources from outside Brewendolf, and tax legislation allowances can change. And remember that when you invest, your capital is at risk. Values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. China's influence on the world seems bound to increase, but there remain huge uncertainties about how it's going to bring that influence to bear. And that is the topic of this podcast, which is going to begin in just a few seconds. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this latest Bruin podcast, in which we're going to be speaking to the author of a new book, The Great Decoupling, about relations between China and the United States. And the author is Nigel Inkster. He worked for the International Institute of Strategic Studies, a London-based think tank, for 10 years up until 2017. Prior to that, he spent 31 years in the British Secret Intelligence Service. So someone with an unparalleled knowledge of some of these very sensitive extremely intriguing matters. So, Nigel, many thanks for joining us. Welcome to the podcast.
My pleasure.
I wonder if we could if you could give us just a bit of a history lesson. I mean, this is the year in which Chinese Communist Party is going to be celebrating its centenary. It's an event that's obviously very important to China, but I think it's something that's quite important to the rest of us for a number of reasons. But one of the things that I think you really get a good insight into from your book is what happened 100 years ago and the impact that it might have on the way we view China today. So I wonder if you'd be able to give us a sort of potted history of where the CCP came from.
Yes, of course. Well, I think we need to cast back a bit further to the mid-19th century, specifically 1839, a time when China seemed to be at its kind of apogee as a traditional imperial power. It was a very big, very wealthy country. But also not as technologically advanced as Western powers then were becoming. And the British wanted to trade with China. China remained a closed economy. And, to cut a long story very short, essentially Britain used its superior technology, its naval power, to kick the door in. And at that point, China went from being, one of the greatest countries on earth to a kind of semi-colonial power, very much dominated by the West. That set off a desperate search for a kind of modern identity that nonetheless preserved China's unique civilizational character. At the end of World War One, China felt that its efforts to help the victorious allies should be recompensed, including in the form of giving back some of the foreign territories that Western powers had taken. This was denied at the Treaty of Versailles, and this set in train a very long process of political activity, all tied up with China's efforts to develop a modern identity. And one of the things that happened in 1921 was a tiny group of people in Shanghai set up the first ever meeting of the Chinese Communist Party, which at that point was very much dominated by the Soviet Union. And for the next 20 years, the Chinese Communist Party was a very fragile flower and almost extinguished on many occasions. But the Sino-Japanese War actually came to their rescue. They were able to establish themselves up in the northwest of China, some distance away from the west of the fighting. Then they were able to rebuild. And after the war, they were able to take on Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist forces in 1949, setting up the People's Republic as we know it today. So that is very much a potted history, but as I said, it's very much about China's struggle for a modern identity. You're looking for ideas from around the world that would help it address the challenge it faced. It opted for the communist route. And of course, we now see that China is not only the only country in the world that is governed by, well, practically the only country in the world governed by a communist party. We also have Vietnam and we have North Korea, but also a Chinese communist party that, in contrast to the Soviet Union, in contrast to Eastern Europe under the Soviets, has become remarkably successful and prosperous.
And you spent the establishment of the People's Republic of China there. I mean, is it relevant to bring in the establishment of the Republic of China in that context as well?
Yeah, that's a very fair point, because, of course, in the 1920s, after the collapse of the traditional Chinese Qing dynasty, which occurred in 1911, China lapsed into a period of significant political chaos, dominated by regional warlords. But the Nationalist Party, set up by veteran revolutionary Sun Yat-sen, with the help of the Soviet Union, developed an embryonic government and military capabilities. And under Chiang Kai-shek, who eventually became the president of China in the 1920s and 30s, undertook a reunification campaign in which they took on various warlords and reunified the country, establishing their capital in Nanjing in the south of China. And initially, the Chinese Communist Party were ordered by Moscow to collaborate with Chiang Kai-shek. But after Chiang Kai-shek established himself, he turned on the communists and launched a succession of massacres and military assaults on them. But between the mid-1920s and 1949, when the nationalists fled to Taiwan and established a separate administration, it was the nationalists who were governing China. And we shouldn't be kind of overly sort of starry-eyed about what the nationalists were, because they took a lot of their inspiration from German-style national socialism. And when Chiang Kai-shek and his forces fled to Taiwan in 1949, they established a regime that was every bit as authoritarian as the Chinese Communist Party. But in the 1990s, we saw a liberalization and Taiwan turned into what we now know it to be, which is a genuine liberal democracy.
So coming back then to the People's Republic and thinking, I guess bringing what we know about the origins of the People's Republic and applying that to the current state. I mean, what does it inform us in terms of the objectives that the Chinese Communist Party are going to have going forwards?
Yeah. Well, at the time, when the People's Republic was first established under Mao Zedong, the kind of key issue that dominated everything right up until the mid-1970s was the issue of class struggle. And that took precedence over all other considerations, very much to the detriment of the Chinese economy, which had significant potential, but was essentially derailed by a succession of violent political movements that kind of really slowed it down. After the end of the Cultural Revolution, which ended in 1976, and for 10 years amounted to, in effect, a kind of collective national nervous breakdown, the Chinese Communist Party decided that the key priority would be to develop the economy, and everything was focused on that with considerable success. And if you like, the offer that the Chinese Communist Party now makes to the Chinese people is that they will deliver economic prosperity and they will also achieve national reunification and re-establish China's standing as a great power, in return for which the Chinese people will allow them to govern and not contest their authority. Now, you can argue that to a very significant degree, the Chinese Communist Party has succeeded in its first objective. There are still high levels of poverty in China. It's still a very unequal society, but it is on track to becoming, if it hasn't already become, the world's biggest economy. And we're seeing a China that is modern, prosperous, progressive, and technologically enabled. National reunification is still kind of on the drawing board, if you like. China got back Macau and Hong Kong from the Portuguese and the British peacefully during the 1990s. That was done through diplomatic negotiation. But they haven't got back Taiwan, and not only have they not got back Taiwan, but Taiwan has arguably slipped further away than it had been, say, 20 years ago, when the emphasis was very much on peaceful reunification. So that is kind of unfinished business for the People's Republic, and it's an open question when and how that particular bit of business is going to be completed. And of course, much depends on factors that the Chinese Communist Party can't control. But it is very much on the agenda. So I think this year, 2021, the centenary of the establishment of the Chinese Communist Party, we're going to see the Chinese Communist Party quite legitimately claiming a significant success in terms of establishing a modern, prosperous economy, a country that can hold its head high in the international community, unlike in the 19th century when China was being belittled in the Western media as a kind of sick man of Asia. That term was actually used regularly back then. That will be a moment at which the current leader of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping, can take a victory lap. But of course, there's much more still to do.
So this objective of reunification with Taiwan, you've cast that in a sort of cultural historic light there. Is that the correct way to look at it? Is it a point of historical importance? Is it this technological strategic importance of from a military or a commercial perspective that makes Taiwan so important to China?
Well, it's all of the above. It is an issue of national honor for the Chinese Communist Party, and we shouldn't underestimate the importance of honor. I mean, the Greek historian Thucydides, said that the drivers of war are fear, honor, and advantage. And, Taiwan kind of ticks all those boxes. But from a strategic point of view, Taiwan is very important, because if the PRC were to reunify with Taiwan, this would have very significant strategic implications for control of the West Pacific. At the moment, the United States has bases and control of what's called the first island chain, chain of islands that runs along the Chinese coastline, starting with Japan and going all the way around to Vietnam. And as long as the United States controls that terrain, China is kind of strategically boxed in. Lose Taiwan and the situation changes. But also, Taiwan is very significant from a technology point of view for one very specific reason, which is that the Taiwanese company TSMC is currently responsible for producing 55% of the world's supplies of advanced microchips. I mean, you know, this is a really big deal. You know, the reason TSMC has done this is because, it's become what is known in the business as a pure play foundry. In other words, TSMC doesn't design chips. It simply manufactures chips that other people design. It's invested very heavily in this. You've got this unique set of capabilities. And were that to suffer disruption or to change hands in terms of access and ownership, the implications globally would be very, very significant. At the moment, the United States is imposing on China an embargo of advanced microprocessors that contain any US intellectual property. And this is really holding China back at a kind of critical stage in its efforts to become a major global technology player. So, you know, in a sense, Taiwan is the place where kind of everything comes together in terms of China's geostrategic aspirations, US determination to remain the dominant player in the Western Pacific, and the struggle for technological supremacy, which is, you pointed out, is the subject of the book that I've just written. So this is where it all comes together.
So in terms of how we should see that delicate sort of relationship, I mean, is it right to think of these powers as having been in this kind of state of equilibrium until relatively recently, or with their reliance on the semiconductor, the different parts of the semiconductor supply chain, their reliance on TSMC, and this kind of strategic ambiguity in terms of policy? Has that changed as a result of the Trump administration, or has that just highlighted something which was already changing or yeah, bound to change at some stage in the future?
Yeah, it's very much the latter. I mean, you know, Trump was a kind of, you know, the Trump administration served as a catalyst for processes that have been in the works for quite some time. We're seeing, and the term that the Chinese use in all their, you know, official publications is, you know, that the world is, you know, going through a period of change not seen for 100 years, and they're absolutely right about that. You know, we've been talking for a long time, people in the kind of, you know, international relations and strategic studies community, about a shift of shift of power from west to east, but now we're actually seeing it kind of happening before our eyes. From the time when Richard Nixon went to China in 1972 and initiated a rapprochement, there was a period during which US and Chinese interests coincided, you know, to a significant degree. Firstly, in joining forces to contain the Soviet Union, and then in terms of helping China to develop its economy. And for a lot of that time, China was at pains to behave as a status quo power, not to rock the boat, not to, you know, be in any way assertive. Everything was focused on that. But as China succeeded, inevitably strains in the relationship started to come out. By the mid 2000s, you know, China was clearly on the way to becoming a power of consequence. Question was then what sort of power China was going to be, and we're now getting the answer to that question, that it's going to be very strong, it's going to be very assertive, you know, it's no longer content to be a status quo power, wants to see changes in the global regime of international governance that you know, better accommodates its interests. And, you know, this is, of course, when we get a kind of classic situation of a standoff between an incumbent power, the United States, and a rising power, China, and you know how these two work out a modus vivendi, if indeed they do manage to work out a modus vivendi, is going to be one of the key questions that determines the shape of the 21st century. It really kind of boils down to that. And it's not at all clear at the moment how this is going to play out. You know, there are an awful lot of moving parts. In a sense, everything to play for. I think it's pretty clear that we're seeing a situation in which China is posing a quite significant challenge to, long-held US presumptions of supremacy, driven by technology superiority. It's obvious that the USA now has quite a lot of ground to make up.
I asked you earlier about the Trump administration. Turning to the Chinese side, how much of this this revelation of China's ambitions is personally associated with Xi Jinping? Has he really changed the way that we should view China going forwards?
Again, I think in a way, like Trump, one should see him more as a catalyst for hastening processes that were already underway, because we saw under Xi Jinping's predecessor, Hu Jintao, who was a very, very different personality altogether, and much less confident in his role, that China was already starting to rub up against the United States, and it was clear that things were going to get more difficult. But what Xi Jinping has done is kind of bring all that forward, accelerate it, and concentrate it. When Xi Jinping was appointed Secretary General of the Communist Party in 2012, he was facing some pretty serious headwinds in the shape of pervasive corruption, which was kind of eating at the soul of the Chinese Communist Party. And the first thing he had to do was to launch a massive and ongoing anti-corruption campaign, which also, of course, was very, very convenient in terms of his ability to neutralize his many political opponents. And he's done this very successfully. What he's also done is taken very direct control of all the key levers of the state and driven forward military modernization, technology modernization, economic reform, all of these areas. It's been push, it's a relentless efforts to achieve some very ambitious and demanding objectives. And up to now, we have to acknowledge that he's been remarkably successful in this. At the same time, of course, in order to achieve his objectives, he's had to promote a progressively more illiberal domestic agenda. And this is starting, I think, to chafe. And he has made lots of enemies. A lot of people, particularly wealthy entrepreneurs, are very unhappy about the kind of general direction of travel. And I think actually quite a lot of people in the Chinese elite are unhappy about the way that he has taken on the United States at a time when they don't think China is ready for this and shouldn't be doing it. I think it's quite interesting that it's that is the main concern, not whether in absolute terms China should take on the United States. But should it be doing so quite yet? Is really the big question that they are asking. And of course, we're not going to know unless and until the balloon goes up. And there are many ways in which that could happen.
Yes, I mean, so let's be to be explicit. One of those developments would be that China might try and retake Taiwan by force, right? That's one of the possible outcomes. And I suppose in terms of what you were saying about Xi Jinping's confidence about the rebuilding of the military, when I look at a map and you look at China and you look at Taiwan and then you sort of you look at statistics about military capability, it looks like a huge mismatch that would just be a fait accompli were China to make the move. I mean, is that an oversimplification?
Yeah, I think it is a bit, because it depends what you mean by taking Taiwan militarily, because of course if it were to be an amphibious assault, that is the most difficult military operation that you can do, a contested amphibious assault. The Americans considered doing it during World War II when it was under Japanese occupation, and they concluded that they were going to need more resources than Eisenhower needed to undertake the D-Day landings. So, they thought better of it. And of course, this is before you take into account the $64,000 question of whether the United States and other countries, possibly Japan, Australia, even the France and the UK, might also get involved in pushing back. And I think that China feels that still time is on its side. It can afford to exercise strategic patience. It can continue to kind of squeeze Taiwan from various directions, and it could significantly up the ante by, for example, naval blockades and other forms of pressure that amount to activities short of full-blown conflict that might actually bring Taiwan to heel. If, on the other hand, something were to happen to convince the leadership in Beijing that Taiwan was slipping away from them, then I think they might feel they had no choice but to undertake a full-blown military assault. And this would necessarily involve a lot of things like bombarding the island with missiles to take out much of its capability. It would involve cyber attacks. It would involve an economic blockade. All of these things, and much would depend on whether and how the Taiwanese actually decided to resist. What they could do in principle is what the Swiss threatened to do when Hitler was about to invade Switzerland in 1940. They said, if you do this, our army will destroy the country's infrastructure, blow up all the dams, flood the central plain, and take to the mountains. So basically, you'll be taking over a giant lake of no economic value. Good luck with that one. And Hitler decided against it. The Taiwanese could, in a way, do something similar, but I'm not sure they will.
There's obviously so much we could talk about with you here, but I know we're running a bit short of time. So I suppose, and also, I want to leave an incentive for people to buy and read the book, of course, as well. But one thing that always sticks my mind is a prominent American banker saying that he feels America's anxiety over this kind of technological standoff is unfounded, because in the US, the development of technology has been driven by market forces. In China, it's the result of this sort of grand strategy. And his confidence, of course, was that going forwards, that the market forces are going to be a much more effective driver of technological development than state strategy. I wondered if I could just get your perspective on that view.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is, I think, the key question. And there are plenty of people in China who also feel that China would do better to rely on market forces in the way that the United States has done. On the other hand, history suggests that it can be very difficult for a country relying on kind of laissez-faire market economics successfully to confront a state that is mobilized on an all-of-nation basis to achieve strategic objectives. And, you know, a case in point is Britain and Germany during World War One. You know, Britain initially relied for munitions production on, you know, laissez-faire liberal policies, and it really wasn't working in the face of an imperial Germany mobilized on an all-of-nation basis. And, you know, the UK essentially had to go down the, you know, all-of-nation route and kind of crash the gears in order to address the shortfall. And I think in a way, it's almost inevitable that the United States is going to have to do this to some degree. You know, the market is a very powerful mechanism in many ways. But, you know, Adam Smith himself acknowledged that the market wasn't the answer to everything, and that sometimes national governments would have to intervene. And my sense is that this is essentially where the United States now finds itself. That doesn't mean that they have to abandon, you know, the free market. But I think, you know, there is a kind of happy medium where the government creates an enabling environment for the pursuit of certain strategic objectives, which the private sector then deliver on. And this worked very successfully during the 1950s, 60s and 70s. But at the end of the day, what we're seeing here is a kind of gigantic experiment going on between the Chinese approach, which was top-down state-led, versus the American approach. And frankly, it's anybody's guess which one is going to prevail.
Okay, well, Nigel, thanks very much for that. And thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. If only we had longer to talk. But for those whose appetite has been whetted, just a reminder that Nigel's book is called The Great Decoupling. I should also mention that Nigel's work came to our attention because of his work with Inodo Economics, to whom we subscribe for research on China, and who are, I think, the preeminent suppliers of that kind of research across both economic and geopolitical spectrums as well. So thanks very much to you, Nigel. Thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you found this an interesting, if not altogether reassuring, podcast. And hopefully you'll join us again on the next edition of the Bruin Podcast as well.